The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Diagnosis of peripheral arterial diseases is presented by Dr. Robert Bender.
All right. So let's finish up with congenital disease. And you know, you think, well, it's probably not that important. I'm doing, you know, adult medicine. But number one, there still is congenital stuff out there that has not yet been diagnosed that you can pick up in adults. And number two, more as you know, treatment of kids with congenital disease has become more sophisticated. We have more survivors into adulthood, so you need to at least be familiar with the terminology and maybe some things to watch out for that are common to a particular congenital lesion. But you can see not very common, less than 1% of births will have a congenital heart lesion, with the exception of bicuspid aortic valve, as I already mentioned previously in the AS talk, about 1-2% of the general population. So if you ain't seeing this, then there's something wrong with the person reading the echoes, because, I mean, everybody should see bicuspid aortic valve. But short of that, you can see the most common lesion is a VSD. I put this down not because, I mean, most of these, with the exception of perhaps Down syndrome, but many of these are either uncommon or rare, but they like to put these on boards, and I know for a fact that in the past they've had on things like cartageners. I think that was on the pulmonary section of boards at one point in the past, but you can see they have dextrocardia as part of the syndrome. A number of the muscular dystrophies can develop cardiomyopathy, so Becker's and some of the other ones. Turner syndrome, you know, obviously not very common, but coarctation of the aorta and bicuspid aortic valve. Holt-Oram syndrome, I have seen a couple cases of those. There seems to be an increased incidence in the Amish population, but they have orthopedic abnormalities like a fingerized thumb, and they, from a cardiac standpoint, increased incidence of ASD. So we already talked about the bicuspid aortic valve a bit, 1-2% of the general population, and they can get AS or AR or a combination of AS and AR, but when you see a patient that has been found to have a bicuspid aortic valve, regardless of the severity of their AS or AR, and sometimes if you pick them up early, they may not even have significant dysfunction of the valve yet, but their first-degree relatives need to be screened, not only to see whether they have a bicuspid valve, but also whether they have the you know, ascending aortopathy, because the two tend to go together, and you can have one or the other or both with this lesion. The only thing is that, and I actually have about three or four patients who actually required surgery, but before the valve lesion became severe, and that was because the ascending aorta was large enough. And the usual cutoff nowadays is 5.5. Some surgeons may take them at a little smaller size if there's, say, a family history of dissection or something, but 5.5 is kind of the cutoff in our current guidelines. Coarctation of the aorta, actually, this is rare, but maybe not as rare as you might think it is. I've already had two people that I've found with it in the last 10 years. I know that doesn't sound like a lot, but these are usually patients that have resistant hypertension, younger patients, and they get sent to you because the primary just can't control their hypertension. Don't forget to do a physical exam on these patients. The first patient I saw with this, before I even got done talking with him, I'm trying to find his pedal and femoral pulses, and he was this young, lean guy. I couldn't find any. He had these big, you know, his radial and carotid pulses were great. So physical exam is very helpful, but these patients will have hypertension in the upper extremities and frequently delayed pulses in the lower extremities. There's an increased incidence of bicuspid valve and congenital aneurysm of the circle of Willis. So those things are very kind of classic things that go along with COARC, so you probably should remember those for boards. The classic finding on chest x-ray actually is rib notching, but you usually won't see this unless you see a patient who has not been treated by the time they reach adulthood. I mean, a lot of these patients are going to get treated as kids, but not always. But there are concerns both before and after repair, and even though there is generally fairly straightforward treatment, that you can either open up the narrowed area. So the COARC, there's a narrowing of the, usually it's in the proximal descending thoracic aorta, but you can, it can be stented. They can also go to the OR, and it can be repaired in the OR, and there's kind of some finer points on who might be a better candidate for one or the other, which I don't think that's the goal here. But even after repair, especially if they don't get repaired until they reach adulthood, they frequently persist with hypertension. They can have accelerated coronary disease, and the repair site needs to continue to be monitored every few years with imaging to make sure they don't develop aneurysm or develop dissection at the site of the repair. This is actually a patient of mine, and you can see the narrowing of the proximal descending thoracic aorta, usually just after in the region of the takeoff of the left subclavian artery. Secundum ASD is the, at least as far as what you're going to see in adults, is other than bicuspid aortic valve, is probably the most common. And most of them, most of the ASDs, of which you can see there's four types, the secundum is the most common. And that's the one where the defect is usually kind of in the middle of the atrial septum. There is an increased incidence of mitral valve prolapse with this. And so you get a left to right shunt. And these patients actually, despite having significant shunt, may be asymptomatic actually for decades. I just saw a guy sent to the OR about a year ago. He was like 50, 55 years old and had not been picked up previously. Classic find, there's a number of murmurs that can be heard because of the increased flow through the right heart from the left to right shunt. But from a board standpoint, the classic finding on auscultation is a fixed, not persistent, there's a difference, a fixed, widely split second heart sound. Natural history is dependent on the size of the shunt. And usually the diagnosis should be able to be made with echo. You can get an idea of the size of the shunt with echo, but to get more definitive information on the pulmonary to systemic blood flow ratio, that can be done in the cath lab. Indication for closure, this is off the latest guidelines, and that is right heart enlargement, at least in the absence of severe pulmonary hypertension. Maybe less robust indication history of paradoxical embolus, but perhaps. So in other words, somebody that has either a PFO or ASD, you know, during portions of the cardiac and respiratory cycle, you can have transient flow from right to left. And so that's why even patients with PFO, there's, you know, an association or you can get a stroke from paradoxical embolus. So similar with ASD. PDA, patent ductus arteriosus. So ductus arteriosus closes shortly after birth, and when it closes, then it's called the ligamentum arteriosum, but sometimes it remains open. It connects a pulmonary artery with the proximal descending aorta, and the area of the aorta that it connects with actually is the similar area where you'll usually see COARC, but in this case, this is a small tube between the PA and the descending aorta that remains patent after birth. You can have associated other lesions such as ASD and VSD, and this has a fairly distinct murmur. It's a continuous machinery, so a very harsh murmur, usually loudest in the left infraclavicular area. And the clinical course depends on the size of the shunt, but this is one of the lesions that, if very large, it can result in severe severe pulmonary hypertension with systemic or supersystemic levels and reversal of shunts, so-called Eisenmenger syndrome, which can also be seen with other lesions like a VSD. And this lesion can be closed either with a device or surgical closure, and the current indications are usually enlargement of the left heart because this actually results in a volume overload of the left heart. And so if you have left heart enlargement with a net left to right shunt in the absence of severe pulmonary hypertension. VSD, most common defect at birth, but usually you won't see a significant VSD in an adult, but you can see small VSDs that are left over. Infants that are born with small VSDs, it's not uncommon that they'll just close spontaneously, but obviously if they're large, something usually needs to be done about it. Results in a left to right shunt and overloads the left ventricle. That may be counterintuitive, but if you think about it, most of the shunting is a systolic event, so both the right and the left ventricle are squeezing, and the blood goes through the shunt, and it goes the path of least resistance, which is usually the pulmonary arteries. In other words, the afterload is less generally in the pulmonary circuit than is in the systemic circuit, so when both ventricles are squeezing, blood goes path of least resistance, and so therefore you have increased blood flow into the pulmonary arteries, which eventually dumps back into the left heart. So you actually volume overload the left heart. As with PDA, if you have very large shunts, some of these patients will develop very severe pulmonary hypertension with reversal of shunts, so-called Eisenmenger syndrome. And this is the indications for closure if there's evidence of volume overload in the absence of very severe pulmonary hypertension. Tetralogy of flow. The tetrad is a VSD, pulmonic stenosis, or at least pulmonary outflow tract stenosis, right ventricular hypertrophy, and overriding of the aorta. But the hemodynamically significant lesions are really the first two, the VSD and the pulmonic stenosis, and they can be variable. In other words, the size of the VSD can be small or large. The degree of pulmonic stenosis can be severe or less than severe. And so the interplay between those two will determine the hemodynamic sequelae of this lesion. But I underline squatting. Usually when I underline something, it's something you probably want to be aware of for boards. I know in the past they've had a question where they present a clinical scenario. A young kid in the ER comes in cyanotic, and you see him walking down the hall and he squats because it is thought that squatting can result in relief of hypoxic episodes, so keep that in the back of your mind. Clinical scenario of squatting, tetralogy of flow. Occasionally these patients will survive to adulthood, but most of them are gonna have surgery before they become adults. Epstein's anomaly, that's just a congenital TR, and I'll show you a picture, it'll be a lot easier to understand, but they usually, these patients can have severe tricuspid regurgitation. I underline WPW because there's a fairly significant incidence of Wolff-Parkinson-White in patients that have Epstein's anomaly. And so you can see here, it's like you took the tricuspid valve. This is an apical four-chamber view, and this is the right ventricle, right atrium, left atrium. You can see the mitral valve over here. But normally, the tricuspid valve is just about at the level or slightly above the mitral valve in this view, and you can see it's been like pushed way up into the right ventricle. Okay, so that's Epstein's, and they end up, they usually or frequently will have severe tricuspid regurgitation. Transposition, again, obviously not something you're going to see very often. There's two types, L and D. The way I remember it is L is lucky and D is deadly. So if you're born with detransposition, the baby's not going to survive unless there's a hole in the heart to allow mixing of blood, because this results in two separate circulations. So it's like if you took the aorta and pulmonary artery and you reversed them. So now the pulmonary artery, it comes off the left ventricle, the systemic ventricle, and the aorta comes off the right ventricle. So all the blood coming back to the right heart goes right out the aorta back to the systemic circulation and never gets oxygenated. Similarly, all the blood on the left side of the heart leaves the left ventricle but goes out a pulmonary artery, goes through the lungs, gets oxygenated, but never gets to the systemic circulation. It just comes right back to the left heart. So two separate circulations. You have to have a shunt somewhere to allow mixing of with oxygenated blood to survive. And so these patients are usually going to have surgery when they're an infant. However, L transposition, so-called lucky, it may not be lucky to have this, but it's the way I remember it, is so-called corrected transposition. That doesn't mean surgically corrected. That means it's congenitally corrected. And what we mean by that is that the blood flows normally through the heart, so there's not two separate circulations. So in this case, it's like you took the right and the left ventricle, and in congenital disease, the aortic or the mitral and tricuspid valve, the AV valves, they stay with the ventricle. So when you have all these mixing of different congenital lesions, usually the tricuspid and mitral valves will stay with their ventricle. So in this lesion, it's like you took the right and the left ventricle and you switched them. So now the morphologic right ventricle is the systemic ventricle, and the left AV valve, which normally is a mitral valve, but in this case, you have a morphologic tricuspid valve. So the systemic side of the heart, morphologic right ventricle, morphologic tricuspid valve. And on the right side of the heart, you now have a morphologic left ventricle and morphologic mitral valve. So blood comes back into the right side of the heart and it travels through a morphologic left ventricle, but travels normally into a pulmonary artery through the pulmonary circulation, return to the left atrium, and then crosses the AV valve into a morphologic right ventricle, which is the systemic ventricle. So these patients will get failure of the systemic ventricle in adulthood and also failure of the left AV valve. So those are the two main lesions or the two main problems you have to be aware of. But these patients can survive well into adulthood before they come to attention or require treatment. All right. I do want to show you one thing because this has nothing to do. So Dr. Burke talked about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So this is a classic hemodynamic finding that it wouldn't shock me if they tried to put something like this on internal medicine board. This is Brockenbrough-Brunewald phenomena or effect or sign. And so this is something you can only get this from the cath lab. This is a pressure tracings. And what happens is when that second beat is like a PVC, and you can see before the PVC, there's a little bit of a gradient between the left ventricle and the aorta. You have a PVC, and then there's a pause, which allows for more filling, and then because of Starling forces, the ventricle then squeezes harder than normal, and now the gradient goes up. So post-PVC, the gradient goes up, and the pulse pressure, the difference between the systolic and diastolic, is lower than on the pre-PVC beat. Okay, Brockenbrough-Brunewald, that's a very well-known finding in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and although I don't think it's appropriate to put on internal medicine boards, it's the type of thing that they like. Let's move on to peripheral arterial disease. I won't spend much time on it. Before they bring up my slides, any questions on congenital or valve stuff? So we're going to spend time talking about arteriosclerosis obliterans. That's kind of the run-of-the-mill peripheral arterial disease we see every day. Spend a little bit of time on aneurysmal disease. Probably won't spend much time on acute arterial occlusion. And then lastly, although very uncommon, at least in the United States, Berger's disease. And I put this on because, again, this is the type of thing they like on boards. So we'll start off with arteriosclerosis obliterans. And this is really the bulk of what we see in the office for peripheral arterial disease, 95% of chronic occlusive arterial disease. And it's just generalized disease of the aorta and its main branches. Usually progresses very slowly. There is a heavy male predominance. But on this slide, the important thing is, so you see a patient that has peripheral arterial disease but no history of cardiac disease. These are pretty sobering facts. About a third are going to have clinical coronary disease, but even in the absence of symptoms, if you cathed all of them, there's a significant incidence of at least one vessel being severely narrowed. So that comes into play when you see these patients and the vascular surgeon asks you to clear the patient for surgery. And so you have to be very careful about looking for coronary disease in these patients before sending them off to the OR. Risk factors, it's the risk factors that you might normally associate with coronary disease. However, in peripheral arterial disease patients, I will say smoking is probably even more important in these patients to get them off cigarettes. I read a review recently, and it was, and I forget the time frame, but there's like, if there's a patient with peripheral arterial disease that's symptomatic, they're being treated, if you get them off cigarettes, there's like a 50% reduction in cardiovascular mortality, like in the coming, I don't know, 5 or 10 years or something like that. So it's really imperative to get these patients off of cigarettes. Clinically, when you have ischemia in heart muscle, that's angina, but when you have it in a skeletal muscle, that's claudication. And the site of the symptoms, whether it's the calf muscles or the thigh muscles or the hip, gluteal area, depends on where in the arterial circulation the stenosis is. These patients can progress from having symptoms only with exertion to having rest pain and ulceration. The ankle brachial index is really a very simple, doesn't cost hardly anything, can have your nurse do type of test, and it's a very good screening test. In other words, if the ankle brachial index is 0.9 or less, highly likely that they have peripheral arterial disease. Now, this is regardless of symptoms. This is just screening for peripheral arterial disease. As a matter of fact, even if you have an abnormal ankle brachial index, it may not always correlate well with the degree of symptoms. In other words, you can have a relatively modest decline in ankle brachial index and have a fairly symptomatic patient, and then have another patient who has a fairly low ankle brachial index who hasn't yet developed symptoms. But it is a good way to pick up patients that have peripheral arterial disease. And Bruise are usually not a good indication of the degree of stenosis. You can get Bruise just from having a tortuous vessel without significant stenosis. So you can see the sensitivity and specificity of ankle brachial index in detecting the presence of peripheral arterial disease. Exercise ankle brachial index is very important because sometimes you'll have a patient come in, they'll give you symptoms of what you think is typical claudication. In other words, they walk, doc, my calf hurts. After I walk about 100 yards, I stop, it gets better. So you do ankle brachial indexes in the office and they're like normal and you're kind of scratching your head. So these are the patients that might benefit from having exercise ABIs done because you may actually pick up a drop in ankle brachial index that's done immediately after exercise. Ultrasound is a very simple, inexpensive way to take the next step in evaluation of peripheral arterial disease to try to determine the exact site and extent of stenosis. And it's also a very good test to follow these patients that don't yet need surgical or endovascular intervention. Usually CT angiography, MR angiography, or even contrast angio, usually not done until you get to the point you think the patient's probably going to need intervention. Most of these patients are going to have a stable course, although a small percentage will progress, and an even smaller percentage of those, so a quarter of a quarter, will go on to having an amputation. You should know what critical limb ischemia is. That's a common term used in the peripheral arterial world, and that's people that have severe PAD that have progressed to the point of rest pain and or tissue loss. And if you see somebody with that, and these should prompt you to encourage you to promptly refer them to a vascular specialist. However, most patients with peripheral arterial disease, the important morbidity and mortality thing is more common that they're going to have problems with coronary disease, i.e. angina, MI, and also with strokes. These patients are frequently vasculopaths and have the attendant potential to have problems in a variety of vascular circulations in the body. Medical treatment. So the asymptomatic patient, so you pick up somebody with PAD, but they're not yet symptomatic. You need to focus on risk factors. As I already mentioned, getting them off cigarettes is really key, but they should also be treated aggressively with statin therapy. Antiplatelet therapy, it is only a class 2A, so if they have PAD, asymptomatic, most of these patients are going to get put on antiplatelet therapy, but it's not a class 1 indication. If they are symptomatic, if they have mild to moderate disease, it is a class 1 indication that they get put on an antiplatelet agent. And believe it or not, the treatment, especially with mild to moderate disease, centers on a walking program, and ideally it really should be supervised in the hospital, but most places and for most patients, logistically that doesn't work well. So hopefully you can take the time to explain to them and get them to do a structured home program of walking every day. Generally, they have to walk until they have quite significant symptoms and then stop, let the symptoms resolve, and then start walking again and do that on a regular basis. AAAs, definition, so diameter of 3 centimeters or more. Frequently, this will be picked up with ultrasound. You can see there's a male predominance, and actually if on autopsies on older males, you can see 10% at autopsy of males over the age of 60 years old. So these were people that previously did not have a diagnosis of AAA. 5 to 8 times higher incidence in males than females. It's the most common arterial aneurysm, and most of them occur below the takeoff of the renal arteries. Not all, but most of them do, and that comes into play sometimes in deciding how to treat these patients, in other words, either surgically or with endovascular intervention. So if you find an aneurysm in one place, you should look for aneurysms elsewhere. So that's an important point. And usually these patients are going to be asymptomatic. If they're having symptoms and it's from the AAA, they're probably in trouble, either having active expansion or have already started leaking, and obviously that becomes an emergency. But most of these patients are going to be asymptomatic, and hopefully you pick them up and then follow them with serial ultrasound over time until the aneurysm becomes of sufficient size to require intervention. And usually that cutoff is 5.5 centimeters. Maybe some vascular specialists use a little bit smaller size for females, but I would keep 5.5 in the back of your mind. Same thing as for the ascending aorta. What about screening? In other words, what about people we think might be at increased risk and just doing a screening ultrasound? Well, I think it's the United States Preventive Task Force, at least at the present time, males between the age of 65 and 75 who have ever smoked should probably be screened with an ultrasound one time. Obviously, if they don't have a AAA, you don't need to continue screening them. And depending on which guidelines you look at, there may be some other indications for screening, but certainly if you have a male and perhaps a female and there's a family history of AAA, first degree relative, those patients should probably be screened. Operative mortality, most often related to coronary disease, so that's the importance of a good exam on these patients before they go to the OR and trying to get a sense of the risk of having significant coronary disease. We frequently have a low index to do a pharmacologic stress test on these patients before surgery. I think we're beyond being able to talk about the risk stratifications preoperatively at this time, but this group of patients got to be careful with. Leading cause of perioperative death, coronary disease. I already talked a little bit about monitoring. So if less than 4 centimeters, so remember we said the cutoff for the diagnosis, 3 centimeters, so 3 to 4 centimeters, probably should do an ultrasound about every other year. If it's more than 4 centimeters, but not yet of the size that requires intervention, they should probably have an ultrasound at least once a year. And you can see the timing of surgery, at least dependent on size, 5.5 centimeters or larger. Occasionally, you'll see a patient that has rapid expansion. These are syndromes that, again, with the exception of bicuspid aortic valve syndromes that have as part of the syndrome, patients will have a dilated aorta somewhere, thoracic or abdominal. And so for boards, probably a good idea to be familiar with these, but from a practical standpoint, the bicuspid aortic valve is the big one. Obviously, Loeys Dietz syndrome is something that's usually picked up in kids, so we don't really see it much with adults. I'm not going to spend much time on this. I can't imagine that's going to be on boards. Acute arterial occlusion. The thing here from a medicine standpoint is that some of these patients with acute arterial occlusion is going to be from an embolus that comes from a more proximal site in the cardiovascular system, either someplace in a more proximal artery or from the heart. So frequently these patients will end up having to be screened for atrial fibrillation if they don't already have it, and frequently end up being referred to us for transesophageal echo looking for either left atrial appendage thrombus or perhaps a bulky atherothrombotic plaque in the aortic arch, which could embolize. The six P's of acute arterial occlusion, hopefully you're all familiar with these. It's pain, usually of rapid onset, a cold limb. The limb becomes pale, pulseless, and if they've already developed paresthesias and especially paralysis, that usually indicates a much lower likelihood that you're going to be able to salvage that limb. From an internist standpoint, some of the chemical changes that occur with acute occlusion, in other words, release of potassium, sometimes substantial elevation in myoglobin, CPK, elevations in lactic acid can result in hyperkalemia, acidosis, and/or renal failure. So those are things that may need to be managed by an internist. And then assuming that perfusion is restored, you can get washout of potassium and lactic acid, resulting in arrhythmia and hemodynamic instability. So those are two issues to be aware of. And here, this is something that they might like on boards, phlegmasia, cerulea dolens. That's just an acute extensive DVT. And this can present with pain in the legs and decreased pulses. So you have to be a little bit careful. So it's not an arterial problem, it's actually a venous problem, but it's on the differential diagnosis and it's something that they might like for a board question. Most of these patients, you know, you're going to pick up the phone and call whoever's on for vascular surgery and get the patient revascularized, but they should at the very least initially be started on anticoagulant therapy to prevent thrombus propagation. And finally, Berger's disease, and I put this on because, not because we see this very often, but because this is the type of thing they like for boards. So here's the key here. If they present a clinical scenario, young male smoker. Unfortunately, it's small and medium-sized arteries, so trying to revascularize these patients is frequently futile because this is the very distal end of the arterial and also the venous system. But young male smoker, young age of onset, may not have other risk factors other than smoking, tends to occur in patients from the mid and far east. And we're not sure the etiology. However, we do know that smoking is related to progression. So if they continue to smoke, they're going to do poorly. If there's any chance of remission, you got to get them off cigarettes. And since this is a small and medium-sized artery, so the periphery, that's why frequently the symptoms will occur either in the hands or the foot. And I'll show you a picture of somebody that's already developed gangrene in the distal digits. So Berger's disease, as opposed to Berger spelled with, I think, B-U-R-G-E-R-S, which is IgA nephropathy. This Berger's disease is actually a Winnie Werder Berger's disease for those who like trivia.